Today is Thursday, February 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump's close friend and confidant, Roger Stone, is in court again today to be sentenced after being convicted on 7 counts, including lying to Congress, witness tampering, and obstruction of justice. Plus,
Democrats take a huge risk if we just substitute one arrogant billionaire for another.
We take a look at Wednesday's Democratic presidential debate in the United States and the latest on the COVID-19 outbreak. Those stories and more are all coming up next. U.S. President Donald Trump's close friend and confidant, Roger Stone, was in court again today to be sentenced after being convicted on 7 counts in November that included lying to Congress, witness tampering, and obstruction of justice stemming from the 2016 Russian election meddling probe. Joining us now on the phone from Hofstra University is law professor James Sample. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Steve.
So, James, this has been a very interesting development today. The sentencing began at 10 a.m. There's been no announcement as of yet, but the prosecutors currently in the case are actually advocating for a stronger sentencing than what was originally handed out, but then later revised by the DOJ under AG William Barr. What do you make out of this?
This is a script that if you were writing a crime drama in Hollywood, would probably get rejected as implausible. To trace the essentials, the initial prosecutors in the Stone case called for 7 to 9 years. Attorney General Barr intervened. President Trump tweeted his dismay. The Department of Justice then reversed course and called for a lower sentence. The four original prosecutors who brought the Stone case and who achieved a conviction in that case, then resigned from prosecuting the case based on the interference from the Attorney General. And now, in an amazing and frankly unanticipated series of events by basically anyone looking at this from afar, the new team of prosecutors is now arguing for at least the 7 to 9 years and maybe even more than the 7 to 9 years that the original team sought. They will not say, they have not yet said anyway, who ordered the first reversal, and they are defending the initial group of four prosecutors who brought the original case and who then resigned.
If we take a look at judge in the case, you know, there has been a tendency for federal judges to issue sentences lower than the sentencing guidelines. Now that we have this call before the bench to actually up the ante over 7 to 9 years, what does that indicate?
Well, the sentencing guidelines are a range, and so it depends on which particular enhancements apply to raise a sentence, and or which particular instances of judicial discretion might call for lowering a sentence beneath the guidelines. But even within the guidelines, the judges are given a significant bit of discretion. What's fascinating here is that Judge Amy Berman Jackson is faced with a sequence of events where there's clearly a significant possibility that the president will pardon Mr. Stone no matter the sentence. And so I think today the sentence in terms of years is almost second fiddle to what Judge Berman Jackson says in issuing that sentence.
James Sample is a professor at Hofstra University. Thank you very much for your insight today.
Thank you, Steve. Have a great day.
All eyes were on Michael Bloomberg Wednesday night as six Democratic Party hopefuls took to the debate stage in Las Vegas. Now joining us in the studio to bring us up to speed on the results of last night's event is Jim Malone, VOA national correspondent. Jim, thank you for coming in.
Sure, Steve.
So This is the first time Mike Bloomberg was on the stage, and he was there with a bullseye on his back.
Yeah, it's still there, and he may have some bruises this morning after that rough go in Las Vegas. He seemed a little out of his element. He seemed like he walked into the lion's den and got chewed up a bit. I think... Right now, the Democratic race is at a really interesting crossroads. A lot of people were putting money on Bloomberg to be the one candidate who could rally moderates to sort of provide an alternative to Bernie Sanders, who is surging in the Democratic race right now. But after his debate performance, you've got to wonder, will Democrats start to question that premise?
Well, yes. And as you mentioned, this is his first debate. The other candidates have had many opportunities. But what about Joe Biden? He's been struggling in the polls after Ohio, after New Hampshire. How did he perform last night?
Well, he had a fairly strong performance, I'd say, by his debate standards. But the issue really is who broke through. I think Sanders continues to do well. He believes what he believes. And he had a strong performance on the debate stage. I think Elizabeth Warren, the senator from Massachusetts, also had a very strong performance. But it's also a bit of flailing about and sort of, you know, casting stones at the other rivals, and some people think that's because she's in kind of a desperate situation. This race is moving quickly. We have Nevada caucuses on Saturday. A week from Saturday, we have the South Carolina primary. That's probably Joe Biden's last chance, perhaps, to
perform. It's a make or break moment, right?
It could be. And then just a few days after that, we have what we call Super Tuesday, 14 states holding primaries, the largest single haul of delegates in one day. And if Bernie Sanders can continue on this streak and build momentum on Super Tuesday, he may be hard to stop.
We have about a minute left. You mentioned Nevada. You mentioned the primary coming up in a week after that in South Carolina. Do you see any winnowing of the field before Super Tuesday, or is that going to be the make-or-break moment for a lot of the candidates?
Not sure. I think Super Tuesday is more likely that point. That's a little later than in some election cycles. Here's the issue. You have Bernie Sanders at about a quarter to a third of the Democratic Party getting support. But he's benefiting from the fact that you have, you know, five or six moderates trying to battle one another to be the alternative to him. As long as that goes on, and I think that debate last night basically cemented that it's going to go on for a while, I think Sanders is the beneficiary right now as the moderates keep looking for who's the candidate who can take on Bernie.
Jim Malone is our national correspondent. Thank you very much for stopping in the studio today.
My pleasure.
And still to come,
how freedom and democracy works in this country through me. So that is my purpose, you know, to let them be educated.
And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Medical professionals have long recommended a healthy diet, exercise, and medications to patients who have high risk factors for maladies like heart disease, diabetes, or stroke. A new study from researchers at the University of California, San Diego, and the Salk Institute for Biological Studies provides evidence that a form of sporadic fasting called time-restricted eating helped improve the health of volunteer participants who had some or all of those risk factors. To follow a time-restricted eating program, you eat your entire daily intake of food over only a certain number of hours each day, and fasting for the remainder of the day. The researchers found that when their study volunteers limited their eating to 10 hours or less each day over a 12-week period, they lost weight, reduced abdominal fat, lowered their blood pressure and cholesterol, and were able to maintain stable blood sugar and insulin levels. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Research suggests the coronavirus, COVID-19, is more contagious than originally thought. Although China reported a sharp drop in new cases Thursday, the data was partly due to a change in how it diagnoses the virus, and the figures could not quell growing alarm about its spread. The coronavirus has now infected some 75,000 people and killed about 2,100. The vast majority of the cases and deaths have been in China, but the global spread appears inexorable. South Korea confirmed its first death from the virus hours after the mayor of its fourth largest city, Daegu, urged residents to stay indoors after a spike of 53 new infections mostly traced back to a church attended by a 61-year-old woman known simply as Patient 31. Experts are also criticizing Japan's handling of the coronavirus outbreak on the Diamond Princess cruise ship, which claimed the lives of two elderly passengers Thursday. Reuters' Gloria So has this update.
The deceased passengers were a man and a woman in their 80s. Professor Kentaro Iwata, an infection control specialist at Kobe University Hospital, criticized Japan's handling of the virus outbreak on the cruise ship.
It turned out that the cruise ship was completely inadequate in terms of the infection control. There was no distinction between the green zone, which is free of infection, and the red zone, which is potentially contaminated by virus. There was no single professional infection control person inside the ship, and there was nobody in charge of infection prevention as a professional. The bureaucrats were in charge of everything.
Diamond Princess, which was carrying nearly 4,000 people, has been quarantined in Yokohama since February 3rd, but passengers were not confined to their rooms until February 5th. Japanese Health Minister Katsunobu Kato defended Tokyo's efforts in a report by NHK, saying, quote, "We have, to the extent possible, taken appropriate steps to prevent serious cases." Yet even as the first passengers disembarked on Wednesday, Japanese authorities announced 79 new cases were discovered on board. The rapid spread of the virus on this ship makes it the largest cluster of infections outside mainland China. A second group of about 600 Japanese and foreign passengers are set to disembark on Thursday after spending 2 weeks quarantined on board. Countries like Australia and the United States have begun evacuating their citizens with plans to quarantine them again upon return.
That was Reuters reporter Gloria So. A gunman suspected of shooting 9 people dead at 2 hookah bars in southwestern Germany, the city of Hanau, 25 kilometers east of Frankfurt, confirmed the worst fears of Germany's top security officials. The gunman was found dead in his apartment after the attack, along with the body of a 72-year-old mother. The 43-year-old gunman, a local sports marksman, left a 24-page manifesto and a video detailing his hatred for foreigners and migrants and his desire for the extermination of Muslim-majority countries. Chancellor Angela Merkel said that while the circumstances of the attack still needed to be fully investigated, the shootings exposed the poison of racism in Germany and pledged to stand up against those who seek to divide the country. Google is planning to move its British users' accounts out of the reach of the European Union privacy regulations, placing them under U.S. jurisdiction instead. The shift, prompted by Britain's exit from the EU, will leave the sensitive personal information of tens of millions with less protection within easier reach of British law enforcement. Alphabet Incorporated's Google intends to require its British users to acknowledge new terms of service, including the new jurisdiction, according to people familiar with the plans. China warned Thursday that it may take more action against the Wall Street Journal a day after revoking the press credentials of 3 of the newspaper's correspondents over a column that China said was racist. International Edition's Kate Pound Dawson spoke to Marcus Brockley, a longtime correspondent for the Journal in China and the paper's managing editor, before going to lead the Washington Post.
There are two trends that are converging here. The first is that China has, for a long period of time, been escalating its efforts to control or intimidate foreign journalists in China. At the same time, there has been an increase in the number of foreign journalists in China who are covering stories more closely and aggressively than before. China has been concerned for a long time that the way that foreign journalists cover it can be both embarrassing at times for the regime, critical in their esteem, and they have used efforts like this to try to intimidate journalists. I don't think it works particularly well. The second trend that's converging at the same time is obviously perhaps the more immediate issue, the coronavirus scare in China. The government has come under robust criticism from its own citizens for the way it's handled the coronavirus and for its efforts to control information flows around the spread of the disease by identifying and making an enemy of a U.S. media outlet for a unfortunate headline on a single opinion piece, they've been able to create a distraction and a nationalistic frenzy of online anger, which takes away, I think, in some ways, from the government's challenges with its own population over the coronavirus.
How typical is this sort of action of China? Have there been a lot of expulsions in the past?
China's history, since it opened up, you know, China basically closed off to most foreign journalists in 1949 when the communists came to power. In 1979, when the U.S. and China restored diplomatic relations, there were a lot more journalists suddenly in China. And every few years, there would be some journalists that would get crosswise with the Chinese government. The Chinese government in the 1980s and 90s, I think, was somewhat more, I would say, respectful or possibly intimidated by the power of journalists. And so it moved a little bit more carefully when it took on foreign media organizations. They did expel some journalists. Famously, John Burns of the New York Times was expelled at one point. A number of journalists were denied visas or forced out of the country after Tiananmen Square. It would be a mistake to assume there's been no progress in journalism or information flows in China. China is actually a far more information-porous place today than it was in the past, which makes the work that foreign journalists do both a bigger problem and more of an opportunity for the government if the government wants to push back, because the government is pushing back in a way that's visible to its people. Today, if the government expels foreign journalists, it plays into a nationalist impulse, which runs pretty wild on WeChat, which is the main social media platform in China. And so people are aware of what's happening, and the government is actually playing this, you know, it's serving different purposes when it expels journalists like it's done this time.
That was Marcus Brockley, a former correspondent in Asia, speaking to our own K-Pound Dawson. Child and adolescent health experts around the world warn children's health and future are endangered by climate change and harmful commercial marketing practices. Lisa Schlein reports that 40 independent experts participated in a landmark report commissioned by the World Health Organization, the UN Children's Fund, and the British medical journal, The Lancet.
A bleak report says no country is doing enough to protect children's health from climate change, environmental degradation, and exploitative commercial marketing tactics that are leading to a global epidemic of child obesity. Scientists forecast the world will warm by more than 1.5 degrees Celsius in 10 years. The authors of the report warn children already are suffering from the emission of greenhouse gases, which is causing global warming. Anthony Costello is professor of global health and sustainability at University College London and a lead author of the report. He says people globally are suffering from extreme weather events, including drought, floods, heat waves, and the proliferation of diseases such as malaria and dengue.
Combined, the poorest countries are having a long way to go to let their children be healthy. But the wealthier countries are threatening the future of all children through these excessive carbon emissions, which will lead to the problems I discussed.
Costello cites damaging advertising targeted specifically at children and adolescents as another alarming global issue. He says the marketing of harmful products such as sugary drinks, fast food, tobacco, alcohol, gaming, and gambling is threatening the development and health of young people.
We face a massive rise in child obesity, which will have long-term, lifelong effects. We've seen a tenfold increase in obesity since 1975, from 11 million children to 125 million children. We know that advertising preys on children, that in some countries they're seeing 30,000 TV ads a year.
Costello warns the dangers posed by the huge expansion of social media advertising and algorithms aimed at children are even more alarming. Authors of the report are calling for a stop to carbon dioxide emissions so children have a future on this planet. They urge governments to invest in child health and to respect their rights. They say governments should listen to children's voices when making policy decisions. They are pressing for tighter national regulations of harmful commercial marketing and for them to be made an optional protocol in the Convention of the Rights of the Child. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Now, despite having only a few years of experience living in a democratic country, an increasing number of North Korean defectors are becoming involved in South Korean politics. For the first time, two North Korean dictators are candidates in April's South Korean legislative election. VOA's Bill Gallo reports they hope to improve defector status in South Korea and change how South Koreans think of their brothers and sisters to the North.
Around 200 North Korean defectors meeting in Seoul, singing a folk song about the future unification of North and South Korea. They're trying to form the first South Korean political party made up entirely of North Korean defectors. Kang Cho-kwan is helping set up the party. He says no one represents the people of North Korea, and that the approximately 35,000 defectors in South Korea are neglected. But defectors could start to get a small amount of political clout this April, when South Korea holds parliamentary elections. Two North Korean defectors are running as members of the conservative opposition. One of them is Ji Song-ho, a former North Korean street beggar, who lost an arm and a leg during what he says was an attempt to steal coal from a train. Ji fled to the South in 2006 and is now a human rights activist. Ji says he belongs to the younger generation, and as a defector and a disabled person living in Seoul, he hopes to accomplish many things for Korea. Ji says he was spurred to run for office after South Korea forcibly returned two North Korean fishermen in November. Seoul accused the men of killing their captain and 15 other crewmen, but many defectors said the move amounted to sending the men to almost certain death in North Korea. That incident also motivated Tae Young-ho to enter politics. Tae, a former North Korean diplomat, is one of the highest-profile defectors in years. He recently spoke to foreign journalists in Seoul.
And I want to show to the North Korean people how freedom and democracy works in this country through me. So that is my purpose, you know, to let them be educated.
Since moving to the South in 2016, Tae has been highly critical of North Korea. More recently, though, Tae has also begun criticizing the South Korean government. Specifically, he wants better treatment of defectors, many of whom feel discriminated against and are among the poorest group in wealthy South Korea. Although all North Korean defectors go through a mandatory 3-month training to learn how to live on their own in the capitalist South, many still fall through the cracks. In July, a North Korean defector and her 6-year-old son were found dead in their apartment, apparently having starved to death. Although the government said this week that the average defector monthly income had reached an all-time high, for many it's still not enough. Tae says he wants to make it easier for defectors to get scholarships.
So I want to, you know, give more opportunities to those newly arrived middle-aged people who want to continue their educations, because I'm absolutely sure that one day Korea will be united, and if we are united again, who will go first to North Korea and to do administrations? It must be those people who were from North Korea.
Tae also accuses some in South Korea of trying to appease the North by not bringing up its human rights abuses. Perhaps predictably, North Korea doesn't think much of Tae. Since he left, North Korean state media have given him the label human scum. It's also not clear just how much power Tae and other defectors will be able to amass in South Korea. Most have aligned themselves with conservatives who are badly fractured after the 2017 impeachment of conservative President Park Geun-hye. And some analysts have warned that defectors now risk politicizing their message. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our outstanding production team, director Nadia Taha and engineer Wojtek Czarniak, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can find us by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.